Academics, friends, family, acquaintances, upon inquiring on the topic of my research, would immediately say, but why these women? Why do we care about them? Isn't it all simple? Money and parties. Some immediately label them as being bling. Oh, so you're working on the bling women with their bags and makeup. Then there was another kind of reaction, one which kind of spoke from a position of intimate knowledge of this class, but a different position within this class, those who considered themselves financial elites or cultural elites, but of a lineage of elites. To them, this category of women embodied a new rich class. And almost disdainfully, they'd say, what's there to know about them? They're all social climbers with vulgar money. Another commented, shouldn't you perhaps look at other elite women? You know, the royalty or landed classes from outside Delhi, or the political elite. They will have more interesting histories and stories to tell than these Delhi socialites. Bags and parties, social climbers, vulgar money, as though and as there are different ways of using money, and these women chose to use them in a particular way, a vulgar or a crass way. These responses and reactions made me aware of the general stereotype about rich housewives of the business class, seen essentially as perfect emblems of Veblen's conspicuous consumption, at times also morally vacuous, and almost most certainly proudly entitled. There was little interest in uncovering their lives, of going beyond the material, or also engaging with the material, particularly their uses and their relations to money. These reactions only propelled me further to unpack the seemingly materialistic, simplistic, dominated life worlds of these elite women. My intention here is not to present these women as victims or to salvage their image as sort of not being greedy or privileged or entitled. No, not at all. Instead, my aim is to explicate and understand the elite subjectivities, especially in relation to money, which, as I will present in the talk, are marred by both anxieties and vulnerabilities and dilemmas as much as by pride, entitlement, and privilege. Secondly, these reactions and responses to the topic of my research have encouraged me to think of class both in its vertical dynamics, as it were, and horizontal dimensions, or as Bourdieu calls, class fractions. Bourdieu, in his seminal work, Distinction, explains the use of taste and lifestyle in marking out boundaries within a class. For example, he explained the ways in which fragments from a dominant class would outdo the other fragments of the dominant class by use of cultural capital or other forms of capital. The aim of my work broadly, and this talk specifically, is to bring out the articulations of elite class and elite class fractions. In so doing, I talk about competition that the elites are engaged in to mark their status as high within their group. Crucially, I also focus on the affects of being elite, the fear and anxiety of loss of status and money, of envy, of competition, of developing and performing a sense of self, of pride and entitlement. Here, I focus on the everydayness of being elite, that is constructed by snubs, appeasements, anxiety, competition, and desire. In the ethnographic examples that I will present, my aim is to show how both pride and anxiety form an integral part of the elite life world. My aim is also to explain that elites might be scared or anxious of this pride, and to overcome this, they might look at other aspects of their life, for example, spiritual, which I will discuss, they turn to the spiritual. But the space of the spiritual is also dictated by pride, by privilege, and by glamour, and by show of money. Rachel Sherman's latest book, Uneasy Street, The Anxieties of Affluence, takes a similar perspective on understanding elite women in Manhattan. Her aim is to explain that contrary to popular opinion, elite women are not complacent about their position of privilege. And they want to appear to be moral actors, to be prudent with money, to be careful in good way of spending money. My work, though also speak of affects, takes a different position. For my intent is not to explain what women, elite women are or not are in terms of the binaries of spiritual or prudent or extravagant or moral. Instead, I want to bring out that their worlds are not seamless, that aspects of their lives are coalescent but can also fall apart. Their practices and relations to the modern are different but not disparate. Their lives are about considerations of doubts, of confusions, but it's also about surety of reproduction of their elite status. It is therefore not about being privileged actors or moral actors as disparate prisms, but in fact about being precisely both, of the use of vulgar use of money as well as prudent use of money, of anxiety, of privilege, of glamour and savings, about enticements of the modern and the retreat to the spiritual. So they all come together and they converse with each other rather than as disparate prisms. To elucidate this, I will give you three ethnographic examples, one about their picture-perfect looks, makeups, one on travels, and the other their spiritual leanings. A visit to the DLF Emporio Mall, one of the three malls in Vasant Kunj in Delhi, where these elite women routinely congregate for shopping and catching up over lunch, coffee, or snacks, immediately highlights the homogeneity of their appearances. Hair colored in light brown hues, manicured hand with painted nails, expensive diamonds, perfectly made up faces using many beauty products, perhaps wearing jeans or knee-length dresses and walking on tall heels. I was invited to join a group of eight women on their monthly catch-up meeting, or what's called kitty party, which is the entry point into my foray into these elite women. We can discuss a little bit more about kitty parties in the question answers round. I was invited to one of the kitty parties taking place at the cafe in the atrium of the plush DLF Emporio Mall, which hosts all the luxury brands and is really the go-to place to for all the elites, for all the business elites. So as I joined these group of women and I commented on how glamorous they all looked, it seemed to me that my comment on them being glamorous was taken as a partial compliment and also perhaps a sort of skepticism on my part on why they were looking so glamorous. So one of them, let's call her Ruby Mehta, age 28, mother of two, responded to my compliment on how glamorous they all looked. She said, "It," that is the makeup, "is not all that much. You are not used to it, so you think it is. It is pretty basic, some foundation, lipstick, and eye makeup. We are not like those who hire stylists to dress up every time they step out of the house." Her makeup did not seem very basic to me, and perhaps to her as well, which compelled her to introduce a comparative dimension in responding to the compliment immediately. And she wanted to put herself against the other women who use more makeup. It was in that moment that Ruby had performed her particular class position by evading the overt acknowledgement of the time and money that she spent on her looks by comparing it with those who invest more time and money on their looks, even though they might be from the same economic bracket. These other elite women, were othered by their extravagant indulgence in looking good, which in turn also seemed to indicate that this was not the good way of using money. I then inquired further on these other elite women, and to which another member of the group responded, "There is a trend nowadays for women," and of course she meant rich women, "to hire stylists, clothes, makeup, to make them look like movie stars who make their picture look very perfect, as though they're ready for a photo shoot. It is all a bit too much, I feel. I mean, for weddings or special occasions, I understand, but getting ready like this almost for every day is a bit over the top. We also like to dress up, but we mostly do everything on our own and have a salon where we go to for touch-up, hairs, makeups, but we don't have stylists." In this invocation and clarification of special and everyday, of working by self and hiring others, these particular elite women had not only laid bare the fractions within their elite class, but also invoked a morality, as it were, of what constitutes a good, self-reliant, elite femininity and a good, prudent use of money. I'll come to the second example, which is of travels. Indian elites have a long tradition of establishing holiday homes in different parts of the world and in India, and now more than ever, they're engaging in foreign travel. It was amply evident in my encounters that foreign travel not only allowed a self-fashioning of being elite by demonstrating global knowledge of travel destinations, and of course money to go on these expensive holidays, but also served as a fertile ground of competition amongst the elites who attempted to outdo each other in the choice of location. Sitting in the lounge area of one Mrs. Shamita Khanna in her North Delhi Civil Lines bungalow, I was in attendance of the post-summer get-together of some of her friends and family, which includes a substantial list of the Delhi's business class. Mrs. Khanna, on a telephonic conversation with me 2 weeks before the party, explained that she usually hosts a small dinner in the month of July or August, as during the summer months of May and June, everyone in Delhi is away on a holiday. The post-holiday dinner, then, is a good space and time for all her circle to interact with each other after this hiatus. I was really looking forward to this event, as I was absolutely sure that the dinner would not only be about sharing these experiences of holidays, but also in due process would be about recreating boundaries of exclusivity and eliteness and of performing snobbery. All the families in attendance of that event had traveled offshore for the summer, some for 2 weeks, some for 4 weeks, some up to for 2 months. And those in the latter category usually went away to live with their extended relatives and perhaps mostly in the United States of America. There was also a small but a segment of this guest attendees who had a flat in other parts of the world, especially London, which was quite a popular place to invest in property. Some of the other families gathered in the room also went for holidays, but they had shorter holidays and they did not go to live with families, or nor did they have a property anywhere. But it was this particular category that traveled the most. They stayed in five-star hotels and they played, they performed this eliteness of knowing the exotic locations that we travel quite a bit, and we travel to places where other Indians don't go. So I'll explain this. Sat on one end of a large sofa, I was surrounded by four women, two men in their 40s who were discussing their summer vacations. One of them, let's call him a Mr. Vashisht, a real estate developer, visited Italy and England for a two-week holiday with his wife and two children. When Mrs. Chadha, related to Mr. Vashisht by marriage, inquired whether they went to Rome or Venice, he replied, "Oh no, we have done all these popular spots many years ago. This time we wanted to explore the coastline, so we went to the Amalfi coast and stayed for 5 nights in Positano and traveled to nearby places from there." Joining this conversation was Mrs. Chadha's young daughter, who said, "Oh, Amalfi is beautiful, and what is best is that barely any Indians go there. So you can get away from the Indian crowd for a while. Otherwise, they are everywhere, London, New York." Mr. Vashish added, "Yes, it really is very nice. And so you said, and as you said, not very high on the travel list of Indians. Also, do you know, this is where Raman proposed to Sheila a few months ago." Now, Raman and Sheila were the talk of the business elite circle of Delhi. Raman was the only son of a well-respected construction tycoon who, overlooking the many luring marriage proposals from the super rich of Delhi, fell in love with Sheila, who was not from an old elite business family, but the disdainfully looked upon new. Her father had earned a lot of money from unscrupulous means, said the grapevine. With much inquisitiveness, shock, and gossip from the business circle, their wedding was held in the winter, and it was really the talk of the town, as Sheila's father had used his large sum of newly earned money to put up a spectacle, spending millions of rupees on decorations and inviting some international artists. Their love story had become a much discussed topic at every elite gathering that I went to. And it was not only this inter-class love marriage, as it were, that was the focus of discussion, but the entire process of their courtship, their pre and post wedding celebrations, from where and how Raman proposed at the Amalfi Coast, to their bachelor's party held in Istanbul, to the shopping for their clothes, which happened in London, and their honeymoon destination, Bora Bora Islands. The lure of this wedding topic was therefore not just about the love and the interclass, but its glamorous unfolding, not only in the geographical bounded entity of India, but the trails of other scenic locations outside of India, performing a taste of global travel and money. As the Vashishts' travel to the Amalfi Coast was gaining popularity among the guests, one Mrs. Dang, a few years older to Mr. Vashisht and also twice removed sister-in-law, entered the conversation and said, "Oh yes, I remember, we were traveling to Europe around the same dates as you were in Italy," she said, carefully avoiding mentioning Amalfi Coast, Italy, "whilst we were in Monaco." Much like the swing of the pendulum, the attention of the gathered elites went to the coastline of South France. Mrs. Dank seemed very pleased at this attention. Monaco is viewed as a center of fashion, style, gambling, and royalty for many Indian elites. And after a slump in its popularity, it seems to have come back to dominate their leisure lifestyle, especially because there are a few popular elite weddings have been held there recently. Many guests then began to inquire of the Dang's vacation in Monaco to know if they hired a yacht, if they lived in a ballet-shaped bungalow, what car they hired. Mrs. Dang was thrilled to report to these queries. She went on to provide exacting details of her trip, discussing the wine, praising Monaco's fashion ambience, describing its natural beauty, occasionally complaining about her husband's gambling habits. She looked gleeful and satisfied, as though she had just secured her position of having had the most interesting and unique holiday from amongst her peer. And at least until the next summer, her position of one with good taste and exquisite choice was to remain. At the other corner of the room were 6 to 7 young married women, aged 27, 35, who were also discussing their summer vacations. Some visited the US, some England, some Europe. But the center of attention was this young woman called Smita Verma, who went on a 10-day holiday in Santorini in Greece with her parents, siblings, and husband. Greece is indeed a popular destination with elites, also with the upper middle classes. And Smita was every bit careful in describing her experience as exclusive, perhaps to mark it out from maybe the upper middle classes. So she said, we rented an expensive villa in Santorini. It cost us about 1 lakh per night. With a private pool, open baths, and a patio overlooking the Mediterranean Sea, their villa, as was evident in the pictures that she generously showcased and shared with all of us, certainly exuded luxury and exclusivity. Almost as though to offset this grandeur, Smita started discussing about the cheap yet amazing clothes she bought from the local markets in Greece. She said, things are actually cheap in Greece. I mean, you don't go there to shop for the big luxury brands, but the local stuff is so good. My sister and I picked up so many clothes, dresses, beachwear. It was really quite nice. Smita had juxtaposed a luxurious indulgence with a concern for money, showcasing that she was not all about purchasing the luxurious, but also indulging in the local, the cheap products. This was a performance and perhaps even realization of prudence with money, of not always wanting the most expensive, but also having the flexibility and sensibility to engage with the non-expensive. Now, in these stories and narrations of holidays, I also noted that holidaying was a collective claim to an elite status. However, there's also been a recent trend of women-only travels, where elite women belonging to the same kitty party or extended family travel together without men. The purposes of these short vacations, I was told, was usually shopping, the popular destinations for which was Dubai, Thailand, and occasionally Sri Lanka. The fact that these women-only travels are largely focused on shopping might not seem surprising to us. However, as I spent more time with these elite women, I realized that at times they strategically use these stereotypical gendered image of them as a garb. Let me explain this. As we have seen above, that women travel once or twice a year with their family to these exotic locations. However, if they make any further demands on wanting to go on a vacation just by their girlfriends, their family does not agree or it is frowned upon. They will ask, why does a woman want to go out alone? What about the family? What about the children? What about your responsibilities? So the women find it difficult to express their desire to just take a break from these family responsibilities, which also is kind of strange for some people to realize that why does a housewife want to take any break? Therefore, according to them, it is easier to convince their family to send them for a vacation by playing to the stereotypical image of them, which is that they like to shop. So in other words, it is not necessary that these women desire to go only for shopping holidays, but they find this cause far more favorable for approval than a plea of taking time off. As a non-participant observer of these kitty parties, I happened to meet another bunch of them at the DLF Emporium Mall, and I was witness to the discussion of a shopping holiday. There were looking forward to their shopping trip to Dubai, and I inquired if there was a particular shopping festival going on to which they were going to, and they laughed and they said, Dubai has a perpetual shopping festival. So one of them said to me, Dubai is a great place to shop and sometimes you get great deals and best lines of clothes and bags that you'd find nowhere in the world. But we're not going simply for that, she laughed. We're going there to have a good time. As she said this, Bela winked at other women on the table and they all started laughing. Seeing my muddled look, another, age 28, the youngest of the group who has 2 children and is hailed to be the most physically fit, said, have you not seen Sex and the City 2? It's going to be something like that. We do not choose Abu Dhabi because it is too risky. We wanted a more cosmopolitan place as Dubai. We have a long list of things to do, like go for night safaris, some belly dancing lessons, order lots of booze in our room, and who knows what all. Yet again, everyone started laughing and discussing the details of this trip. I sat there thinking to myself the ways in which these women have appropriated an image of consumption and frivolity to their advantage, to find some freedom away from their family, duties and responsibilities. At that moment, another woman said, I mean, come on, we deserve this. We are always working for our family, managing the household. We also want some me time. We deserve to go for a holiday that is not always with the family, where also we have to just think about kids and make sure that everyone is happy. Contrary to popular opinion, therefore, these elite women's me time is not necessarily dictated by shopping or spending time at the spa. Instead, their desire was to indulge in leisure in unexpected and non-scripted ways. Something that they knew would perhaps be scorned upon or not be heeded to by their family. So they find it more useful to present their want to go on a holiday as dictated by a desire to shop, which they thought, quite rightly, would be more permissible. I also spent time with older elite women aged 55 and above. And one of them, let's say Mrs. Lalwani, wife of a well-respected businessman, invited me for tea at a palatial house in central Delhi. In a long conversation about her leisurely activities, I inquired if she has ever been on women-only holidays, and if at all she, her daughter or daughter-in-law have been on such women-only holidays. She said, "Yes, I do go out with my friends. In fact, we laugh that our group is called the mother-in-law's group, with all the grandmothers and mother-in-law. But I think younger women are still not given much freedom to go on holidays alone." I inquired on why, what she might think is the reason for that, and she said, "The thing is, these girls are so young, and to let them be unchaperoned, who knows what they'd get up to. I mean, some of them are also a bit wild. So we, the older generation, are not very comfortable for them to go about holidaying on their own." It turns out that Mrs. Lalwani's suspicions were not totally unfounded, for the grapevine of Delhi elite circles had much information on certain women-only holiday that had gone awry and had brought shame to at least two of the families. One such incident was of this group of women, again about 27 to 36, who claimed to attend a shopping festival in Dubai. But it was later found out that some of them had engaged in some extramarital shenanigans. It was widely rumored that on this particular holiday, one or two of the six women had rekindled a romance with their ex-boyfriends. Some of the others, it was speculated, made new male acquaintances, leading to short-term romances. At one of the parties, a group of women were discussing this big autumn gossip, and I inquired how at all the news broke out. So one of the ladies speculated that it must be the wife of the ex-boyfriend, and another one said, no, it was actually one of the other ladies who was present at the holiday who leaked the information. Then she said to me, "I don't think it really matters who leaked the information. The fact is that something did happen on this trip. We are sure that there was certainly an ex-lover involved. Imagine how embarrassing this must have been for the Kapoors, whose daughter-in-law was allegedly involved in this affair." To this, another one responded, "People like to gossip. I am sure there are many more than Payal, the girl, who have affairs. But I think when you go out like this on a holiday, the news becomes far more sensational." These grapevines remained largely unchecked, and I hesitated to bring these incidents up too often and remained mostly passive when they were gossiping. Whilst it is interesting from a research point of view to analyze the motivations of these romantic or sexual encounters, rekindled or new outside of marriage, I was equally intrigued by the forum used to explore these encounters, namely that of holidays. It was interesting for me to note that a public activity, as of a holiday, which is usually used to bolster an elite status, an elite class position, was also used as a forum to express assuage anxieties and desires of being an elite woman. In other words, on the one hand, holidaying was used to reiterate a family solidarity, and on the other hand, it was appropriated by the same set of women to get away from these families and duties and indulge in their most private, intimate, and perhaps unlived desires. At once public, at another private, the foreign holidays offered various options to elite women to acquiesce and also to resist, to comply by the demands of being an ideal daughter-in-law or wife, and also push these boundaries by inserting and realizing a self that is not determined by these expectations. A final example is of the religious or the spiritual, the cult of gurus. A number of these elite housewives were ardent followers of gurus. Some were brought up in Hindu families that worshipped in temples. However, some of them chose to pledge allegiance to religious and chose to pledge their religious and spiritual affiliations to specific gurus, not so much to gods or goddesses. The ritual expectations around guru worship, as I later found out, mainly involved following his sermons, organizing events where his sermons were remembered or satsangs, and visiting his ashram regularly. These gurus did not follow the Hindu scriptures or texts in their strict sense, but prescribed a way of life, as it were, influenced by these Hindu texts and also at times other texts, particularly Sikhism. While there are a few specific gurus who have a large following amongst the Delhi elite, I noted the prominence of one. Let's call him Guru Saab, who was from Punjab and fluent in Punjabi, which is also the primary language of many of the elite women that I spend time with. I became aware of his large following during one of my early encounters with these elite women. I was sat with a group of six who were discussing the time and location of their next big kitty party. And one of them said, any time after 2 p.m. would be perfect because I have to go to Guru Saab's ashram in the morning to do seva. Everyone nodded and said that some other women of the kitty group were also heading to the ashram that Sunday, so it was more convenient to move the timing of their leisurely meeting in the evening. As this was really the first time that I encountered any reference to religious and ritual practices in the group, and despite my own little knowledge of what these terms meant, in pursuit of a clarification and also in a desire to know what religious and ritual practices mean for them, I asked them what exactly does it mean to visit an ashram and doing seva. Very broadly, seva translates to service and carries values of humility, charity, and selflessness. And I was really curious to know what exactly entails seva for these women. So one of them responded, many of us follow Guru Saab, the generous and powerful guru. We all seek his blessings and he blesses his followers with happiness and prosperity. We visit his ashram at least twice a month or almost every Sunday if we can, and we do seva there. This could mean a range of activities. She still wouldn't say what seva would mean. So I probed further and then she said, well, we help cook, clean utensils, sweep floors, serve food to the people who are there to listen to his sermons. It was striking to know that much of the rhetoric and discussion around visiting the ashram was not about donations that these families also make, which I was later told, but it was on explaining how they perform seva. There was something, it seemed to me, redeeming and cathartic about physical labor for the rich women that was different and more special than monetary donations. The irony here could not be ignored, wherein while at home these women refrained from doing the direct manual labor, perhaps as part of their class habitus and expectation, and were more involved in managing the household with the help of a staff, whether cooking, general maintenance, or taking care of children, for their spiritual and religious awakening, they insisted on performing the same kind of physical labor outside their home. Moreover, they used the term seva and not work to describe these tasks, thereby associating emotions of service and perhaps other affects, redemption, humility, to the acts of these physical labor. It is also worthy to note here that these women did not immediately explain to me what constituted seva, but it took much cajoling, and after hesitating and reluctantly, they would elucidate. Now, this hesitation, according to me, was not necessarily born out of an embarrassment of admitting of washing utensils or sweeping floors. Quite contrarily, it seemed to be a symptom of humility, performed or real, based on sermon teachings that these acts of seva should not be used to invoke sentiments of arrogance or bragging, but are to be performed with utmost humility and modesty. I inquired further on how they decided to follow this particular guru or godman, whose presence I began to notice in the public spaces of Delhi after this conversation, for his huge face on these big billboards, four or five out of every 10 cars, the back screens has his name, in shops you have his photographs, it's everywhere. They explained that many rich families have recently started following Guru Saab because of his generosity, spirit, and positive thoughts that have helped families in their difficult times. Sonia, age 37, mother of two sons, said, for me, it happened more than a decade ago. I was having some family troubles and was always very sad, depressed, and anxious. It is then that my mother got to know about Guru Saab, as her kitty party friends had begun to follow him. We decided to go to him and seek his blessings, and you will not believe him. When I met him, I did not even have to tell him what my problems were. He looked at me and he knew of my troubles. He said, I should have faith and everything will be all right, and the property issue will be solved out, and my son's health will improve. Within the next week, things at home became better. Our financial problems and family feuds started resolving themselves. I was intrigued and amazed, and perhaps there was a sense of skepticism in my body language and facial expressions, to clarify and address which, she continued, it is hard to explain unless you experience it yourself. I believe in him and his blessings are very dear to me. He took Mahasamadhi a few years ago, but I know he's still around. We all know that. So we go pay our respects and do seva. Mahasamadhi, as Sonia later clarified, meant that the guru had willingly left his body to embrace death, but his spirit still looms and blesses his followers. His followers never use the word death and believe that he's still around watching over them. They still, as much as when he was alive, visit his ashram for seva and conduct regular satsangs with other fellow followers. Seeing my interest in this topic, Sonia invited me to a satsang at her palatial house in South Delhi so I could see for myself the dedication, respect, attachment and love that his followers continue to have for him. On a Sunday afternoon then, I had my first encounter with the large following of Guru Sahib. The house was in one of the most posh residential areas of Delhi, Vasant Vihar, and right from the huge gates, a carpet was laid out leading up to the main hall. As I walked closer to the hall, there were few men handing out small bags to put my footwear, for the satsang had to be attended barefoot, much like when you enter Hindu temples. On the sides of the red carpet were laid out little candles and yellow flowers, reminiscent of a wedding situation. There was a huge gathering of close to 150 people, mostly women, all dressed in most exquisite Indian wear. At the center of the hall was a large framed picture of the Guru. On the right was a Hindu god, on the left a Sikh god. Then the program began with some hymns, and after the hymns, there was Sonia's mother-in-law took the microphone and started sharing her personal experiences of healings and blessings from the Guru. Soon after, several others joined in, including a young girl of 16 discussing her tumultuous time with school examinations, a woman aged 45 who successfully battled cancer, and another woman of 60 who was worried of her daughter's health and her inability to bear more children. Each of these women, rich and famous, without much hesitation, narrated their troubling experiences, which were put to rest by following Guru Sahib's teachings and receiving his blessings. They emphasized that Guru Sahib always urged them to have faith and be patient. Whilst narrating her experience, this lady who was 60-year-old said, "He always wanted us to be patient and kind. He said, things will get better and we will have to do this by stop worrying and just meditate. Be in touch with our spiritual side and ask forgiveness and blessings from God." As a Hindu myself, I've never really encountered this kind of expression of religiosity or spirituality where a group of people gather and discuss their anxieties and lay bare their vulnerabilities. To then witness such a ritual amongst the super rich of Delhi was exciting, perplexing, and revealing. There was certainly something very powerful and intimate about this gathering, as I was witnessing some of the most successful families of India discussing their personal struggles. It was a fascinating experience at another level, for it exposed the range of anxieties and vulnerabilities that mar the life of the rich and powerful, and their need to discuss these issues, not with professional therapists, which they might also be, or which is something the case, I suppose, with non-Indian elites, but in a setting that invokes certain Indian traditions, cultures, and parts of spirituality. It reiterated that elites' lives are not detached from the spiritual or otherworldly, but in fact are guided by these very lives. Of course, there are elements of power, wealth, and privilege to these experiences. It was also striking to note the candor and honesty with which they discussed their struggles and problems with the other elites, without necessarily fearing that any one of them could take advantage of it in whatever form. This, to me, demonstrated a deep sense of trust and bond with each other, a sort of shared class habitus regarding affections of being elite. For they knew that each family, elite family, sitting in that space, also had similar struggles and anxieties. In this sense, the spiritual or religious practice also reiterated class and therefore exclusionary boundaries, for it cultivated a space of expression of anxieties of a particular class and the unsaid rule of keeping it all within themselves. A conspicuous aspect of the cult of the Guru, and also as also evident during the satsang, was the global reach and international character of the Guru himself. One of the ladies who narrated her experience with cancer was an Indian settled in America who first heard about the Guru in the US and attended his sermon in New York. In narrations by other followers too, it was clear that Guru Sahib was well traveled. A lady follower also claimed that he was fond of wearing designer clothes and shoes and encouraged his followers to be well-dressed. It seemed to me that the bond between the Guru and the followers was also born out of a shared appreciation of an international orientation to lifestyle, designer lifestyle, and it seemed that the Guru's blessings and teachings were not contingent on a renunciation of sorts or scrupulousness with money or consumption. It almost allowed the rich to guiltlessly continue to occupy their position of privilege and power. His followers, therefore, were able to occupy both spaces of spirituality and materiality, charity and extravagance, without having to choose between the two, a form of teaching which is certainly conducive and appealing to their elite life goals. Let's conclude. Discussions and works on elites in recent and previous sociological writings has commonly bent towards the gendered category of men. The focus of these works, furthermore, is either on political networks, caste associations, or economic elites, as Surinder Jodhka, who was visiting here recently, his edited volume in a journal, Samaj, shows that it's all like, and he talks more about economic elites. Or Elite Education, Sanjay Srivastava's brilliant comprehensive book on Doon School. Even if elite women are spoken of, the attention is always towards those who've made a mark for themselves in the man's world. There's much work on executive women, executive elites, or political elites. The lives of elite housewives, however, continues to be unexplored by scholarship. Married to successful businessmen and born to also rich families, these women are considered to be outside the realm of production and generation of wealth or having a direct claim to power. Partly because of this image and partly due to problem of access, their lives remains unaccounted for, at least in scholarship. My research is called for an inclusion of the lives of rich housewives in understanding narratives and subjectivities of being elite and of being modern subjects. I intend to bring into conversation the lives of elite in the framework that moves beyond describing them as desperate housewives or socialites. My framework of analysis here remains money, however, not in the strict and simple understanding of spending money for consumption, but instead the myriad meanings attached to the use of money. This is not to say that conspicuous consumption is not integral to the life of these women. In fact, it very much is, for this is how they draw boundaries within their class and also from other classes. But my attempt is also to explain the dynamics between money and enticements of modern life and a cosmopolitan culture and a global culture. For example, as evident through travels to exotic locations, desire to be part of global elite, celebrate spirituality with pomp and show. I interacted with, unlike Rachel Sherman's Elite Women of Manhattan, the women that I interacted with did not shy away from discussing their wealth. In her book, she says they did. Nor did they immediately and almost certainly attach a moral or ethical agenda to the use of their money. Again, Sherman shows that her the elite Manhattan women always associate certain moral acts to their spending of money nowadays. But in my work, I find that elite women are not necessarily trying to portray an image of being one type of elite over the other, of being moral over glamorous or prudent over extravagant. Instead, these worlds all come together and they also collapse because it is also about disjunctures. It's also about confusions. It's not just about one seamless, unified understanding of what their lives is. The moral and material implications of their elite worlds are evident in their everyday aspects of constructions of modern subjects, of being spiritual, of being competitive, of being anxious, and of being entitled. A second aspect of this work is also to understand elite life worlds by focusing on the range of affects. So these elite women desire to look good, they travel well, they compete with their cohort to be a good wife and daughter-in-law. At the same time, they might feel constrained and controlled by these elite life worlds of competition and hierarchy and status maintenance, and therefore find ways to overcome their apprehensions and anxieties. This could be in the form of women-only travels, as we've discussed, or it could be a turn to the spiritual. However, of course, even the turn to the spiritual is imbricated with other aspects, as for example, welfare for the family, and it also transforms into a language of privilege, entitlement, and pride, because they are reinforcing their class boundaries, because these charity events or these satsangs are all happening within a particular class. It's not like a larger, it doesn't include other classes. And also the purpose of this satsang is like a call to maintain their status of privilege. However, following Bourdieu, I want to say that social sciences, this is what he says, that social sciences don't need to construct class, but rather explain the social spaces in which classes are constructed. And through my work, I'm trying to do that. I'm trying to explain the social spaces, whether it is of travel, whether it is of fashion, whether it is of being cosmopolitan or a global elite, and then trying to understand what really being elite entails, which, as I've shown, is not a neat category. Though it is difficult for me at this stage to provide any neat way to close this talk, drawing from a thematic analysis with all the necessary warning of a work in progress, I've attempted to make sense of the elite worlds, which are seemingly simple, but as I will discuss, far more complicated. By focusing on the life of elite housewife, I've also recommended not to shy away from going beyond the structural forces that constitute elite worlds, of focusing on unfulfilled desires, performative aspects of gender, femininity, agency, envy, competition. It is in speaking of all these aspects together, not necessarily as opposed to each other or playing a role in creating strict boundaries, that I think we will be able to analyze in a nuanced way the elite privileges and unsettle the image of elite subjectivities. Thank you.